So our next speaker is Dr. Boris Wurm, who is a marine biologist and associate professor in the Department of Biology at Dalhousie. He's written over 70 publications on the ecosystem effects of fishing and the conservation of marine ecosystems. His work has been featured in major media outlets worldwide. He's received national and international recognition, most recently with the Stacey Award from NSERC of Canada and a Sustainable Science Award from the Ecological Society of America. I can't think of anyone better suited to discuss to give us an informed glimpse on the ecological future of our oceans in Canada. And so Boris is thankfully here to do that.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks, Norman. That was a fascinating talk. I could wrap things up very quickly and say I'm going to talk exactly about what Norman is talking, just in the ocean, and I come to the same conclusions independently. We didn't talk before. But I'm actually hitting on very similar notes, particularly my concerns about our eroding ability to understand what the heck's going on and what it means, and to do something about it. But I'm even more concerned about our ability to monitor change and understand change, because that's the basis for everything. And we're already in the dark, as it were, because there are so many issues that are arising that are completely under our radar. Ram Myers, who was a mentor for myself and for many others, said, I'm most concerned about the things that nobody's concerned about. But if we're eroding our ability to understand these things before they arise, we're really in trouble. And I think we really are in trouble. I first want to make a pitch for the oceans. I know we're a little bit away from the oceans here, but I call Canada the world's ocean superpower because we have the longest coastline in the world. If you would walk 20 kilometers every day for the rest of your life, it would take you 36 years to walk Canada's coastline. It also has the second largest shelf area after Russia. That's important because shelves are the productive parts of the ocean. This is where marine resources are created, particularly fish resources, but then others, oil and gas resources also are found, mainly on shelf seas. Some of the major resources we had on our shelves have been lost. That's very well publicized, collapse of the cod and so on. But then there's many others that are still there and still thriving. And then Canada is also known for its excellence in marine research. It was a leader in marine research for most of its history. And that leading position is certainly being lost now as we're eroding our capacity to conduct marine science and to go out and see what's going on in our oceans. So I just thought my talk is structured as such that I start with the things we know well and end with the things we know little about. And you will also see that the things we know well, we have well-developed solutions for, because we have the understanding to develop those solutions. And in some cases, those solutions are implemented. So with knowledge comes responsibility, comes ways of fixing things. And that's why most well-known problems in the ocean, ecosystem overfishing, habitat degradation, and pollution, are all either trending flat or down. Particularly forms of pollution that we've talked about a lot, like nutrient pollution, industrial pollution, a lot of the major, as you said, some of the major organochlorines, for example, DDT, PCB, and so on, also heavy metals, are also trending down worldwide, actually, in terms of how much of it is released into the environment. Ecosystem overfishing, by which I mean the depletion of stocks and non-target species, so-called bycatch species, and also ecosystem changes that arise from that through trophic interactions similar to the ones that Norman talked about. I'm not going to talk about those in details, but all of these are certainly going on, but they're also probably trending flat as we're understanding them and trying to rebuild some of the stocks that have been lost and trying to conserve some of the bycatch species from going extinct. And then also our ability to degrade habitats through unchecked coastal development, for example, diking of wetlands and so on, or the trawling and dredging of the shelf bottom on our large continental shelves. Through various means, these are also probably not increasing. There's more awareness now about these issues, and trawling and dredging have been reduced in area extent greatly after the collapse of the cod stocks. It's now more concentrated in some areas, and you could argue whether that's a good or a bad thing, because those areas will have less time to recover from these disturbances, so maybe we're doing more damage in fewer areas. But large areas of the shelf are now not trawled regularly anymore because of the collapse of those ground fish resources on the East Coast. So some interesting trends there, but I would say that these three blocks of environmental problems are at least not getting worse rapidly. But I'll give some caveats to that in the next bit. So this is what I call the emerging challenges. The collapse of groundfish resources off the East Coast had an enormous effect on the management of fisheries resources, and it was mostly displacement. So basically, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans was thinking about ways to employ fishers and to build up fisheries resources, non-traditional resources, such as invertebrate fisheries. A very rapid and heavy expansion of invertebrate fisheries, particularly on the East Coast, a rapid expansion of aquaculture on both the West and the East Coast. In Nova Scotia, to give you an example where I live, the provincial government has committed to increasing aquaculture, mostly open net pen salmon aquaculture, by 10% a year over the next 10 years, which means that a lot of our bays are being plastered by aquaculture cages with very little oversight. So that's something we're concerned about. Then there's obviously climate change, particularly in the Arctic. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then acidification, a very broad scale change of the ocean environment, not due to acid rain, but due to increasing carbon dioxide levels, particularly on the Pacific coast, is reaching levels that are already impacting larval development, for example, of oysters and maybe some fishes. And then I'll talk about emerging pollutants, particularly microplastics, which I only recently became aware of. Just as a little scan of what you know, who's aware of the microplastic problem? Okay, so a number of people. Yeah, that's good. Okay, I start with managing fisheries. This is a picture I took on the seafood market in Seattle, and what's interesting about it is it's all invertebrates. And this really reflects the new reality of fisheries, not just there, but also in our regions here. The reason for that is that a lot of the large things that used to dwell in the ocean that we fished or hunted have been reduced by an average of 90%, as this figure shows. So all of the major species groups of large vertebrates in the ocean have been reduced since we started exploiting them. And then some of them, particularly marine mammals and marine birds, have somewhat recovered. Those are the light gray bars there, is the recovery from the historic low point, if you will, on average. This is across 250 different studies, mostly large species that are commercially valuable and have been exploited for a long time. So it may not give the average status for the species group, but certainly for the segment of the species group that's of commercial interest. So I and many others have argued that we need to fundamentally shift in terms of using natural resources in the ocean. We have to fundamentally shift from a focus on exploitation to a focus on recovery and rebuilding. It's really a different mindset, even from let's stop the decline to let's bring it back. You're looking at the world quite differently. And I know this is to be true because this is what people do down south of the border in the United States. The Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act actually mandates rebuilding with the hard target points where you have to change management at certain breakpoints in the depletion sequence and then bring stocks back to their most productive level within 10 years, if possible. Where that has been done, this is documented recoveries in yellow here. And the interesting thing you see here is that the drivers of recovery are the same things that caused extinctions and depletions in the first place over historical time. So you obviously have to dial the things back that caused the damage in the first place, and these tend to be, for historical declines, mostly exploitation and habitat loss, and then to a lesser extent, pollution. And the interesting thing, we're talking about interactions here, that in most of these recoveries, actually three-quarter of them, you had to attack at least two of those underlying causes simultaneously. It wouldn't be enough to reduce exploitation. You also had to rebuild habitats or protect habitats or deal with pollution in order to bring the species back. So I think that's an important lesson, is it's often multi-causal, both in the decline phase and then in the recovery. So for those of you who are not as familiar with fisheries, the beautiful thing about fisheries is Canadians and others have for a long time developed a beautiful theory of fishing that can be used to set targets for management and also for managing recovery and rebuilding of fisheries resources. And this obviously has to be done from an ecosystem perspective. You can't do it species for species because species interact, as Norman showed and as we all know. So what we did here is, this is a paper called Rebuilding Global Fisheries, and we're developing a theory of community biomass and community fishing, and where you should set the target reference points. So what you see on the x-axis is the exploitation rate. So this is the proportion you take out every year. 0.4 means you're taking 40% of the fishable biomass out every year. And as you're cranking up exploitation rate, the total catch goes up to an optimum point called the multi-species maximum sustainable yield. And then over that point, you're overfishing, and you're taking more than grows back the next year, and your total catch goes down. And if you're taking everything, your total catch, the equilibrium catch, will be zero. What's interesting is that this strategy, which is ingrained in fisheries legislation in Canada and elsewhere, is to manage for that optimum point, the maximum sustainable yield, either on a single or multi-species basis, has ecological consequences. Total biomass declines. This is an example community from the East Coast in New England, George's Bank. The total biomass declines to a fraction, maybe one-third of what it was before fishing, and also the average maximum size of species in the community declines. So you're having less and smaller species. But most importantly, you're getting a large increase in the collapse of species, up to 40% of species collapsing by default under a maximum multi-species sustainable yield. So you're doing the right thing to maximize catch, but it entails very large changes in the community and the loss of a significant fraction of the community. Collapse here means a decline of 90% or more in their biomass. So this is the cost, the environmental cost of fishing. And again, I agree with Norman, is this is a societal decision. We have to put value on these different curves and then optimize it to where do we want to be. As I said, the target so far has been to manage for a maximum sustainable yield, because the main objective was feeding a growing world population, and that's fine. But it does come at a large environmental cost that many are not wanting to bear anymore. The additional problem is that the reality was that often for reasons of maximizing employment and ratcheting up fishing pressure, not being able to ratchet it back down in times of where productivity was poor, we typically overfished. Almost all places where we have fished for more than 50 years have been overfished on an ecosystem basis. So that's the reality. And obviously there we're losing on both ends. We're having large environmental effects and we're not getting the maximum output. What we proposed in this paper is to come up with a new target that that still supplies between 80 and 90% of maximum sustainable yield, so you're getting almost the maximum catch, but you're getting it at a much reduced environmental cost. So in this simulation, only 5% instead of 40% of species collapse, and biomass and size structure being much closer to natural levels. This would also be a much more resilient strategy because you're leaving more biomass there, you're leaving more spawners in the water, the reproductive output will be higher, and the community as a whole, as well as single stocks, would probably be more likely to withstand shocks and other environmental disturbances from climate change and so on. The question is, how do you get from one to another? Because the long-term equilibrium output will be the same here and here. So we're actually not sacrificing anything over where we are now. But in order to get there, we have to dial back fishing pressure a whole lot to rebuild biomass to levels where they can produce that amount again. Another beautiful thing about this fisheries conservation sweet spot, if you will, is that it coincides with maximum economic yield. So it's not just that it's ecologically better, it's actually also where profits are higher. The reason for that is that you're dialing back exploitation rate from here to here, and exploitation rate is directly proportional to costs. The harder the fish, the more money and fuel and so on you have to spend to get those fish. There's more fish in the water, less effort. You don't have to go as far out. You don't have to trawl as long to get the same catch. So your profits will be higher at that new target. So rebuilding is working in a jurisdiction that have clear rebuilding plans with where basically overfishing is now by law, it's not possible by law to overfish anymore. As soon as you overfish, these regulations kick in, there's no discussion, and you're entering a rebuilding plan. And we see this, for example, south of the border in Georges Bank Haddock, where the U.S., as soon as the rebuilding plan came in, had this very large increase in biomass of haddock and many other species like scallops, and now this is off the charts here. It's higher than it's ever been in the history of assessing this stock. It's not working in other species that are managed jointly between the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and other countries that fish it. Bluefin tuna is the poster child example, where we have been able to stabilize biomass in the Western Atlantic, still in free fall in the Eastern Atlantic, because there's more players there who decide upon the quotas. But here, despite a rebuilding plan, we haven't been able to bring them back from those very low levels because there's not a commitment, there's no legal framework for preventing overfishing. It's still a matter of discussion and haggling and negotiations. And Canada actually has been very hard pushing for keeping the quotas up and keeping our share, actually increasing our share in this stock. So just a little bit of shame and blame here, the U.S. versus Canada. It's the same or similar picture on the West Coast. I picked the East Coast here because we're closer to it. This is biomass and this is exploitation rate. And one, which I marked here with the blue line, is the level that corresponds to the maximum sustainable yield. So you want a biomass that is at least that. Under the old target, it would be that. Under the new target, it should be higher. And as you see, there was overfishing both in Canada and the U.S. Biomass dropped below that target. And then Magnuson-Stevens Act came in the mid-1990s, and you see since then we have a gradual increase. The size of the dot, by the way, is the number of assessments that went into calculating that average biomass. So in the U.S., it was going downhill. A piece of legislation came in, and they reversed the trajectory consistently. In Canada, I think this more so reflects our national psyche. It went down We said, oh God, we have to bring it back. It went up a bit. We said, oh, we can fish it again. It went down again. It went up a bit again. So I don't know where this is going long term. There's no strategy. There's no plan how we can bring this back. It's a year-to-year, minister-by-minister, lobby-group-by-lobby-group type effort. There's no clear legal framework for turning this around. And you see the same here for the exploitation rate. So it's jumping all over the place depending on who's in office and how bad it looks and what public opinion is and whatever. Whereas in the U.S., exploitation rate was up. Magnuson-Stephen came in, exploitation rate keeps going down. And obviously fisheries are much more profitable there now than they are in our waters, on the East Coast at least. So this is a good news, bad news story, because it said this problem is imminently fixable. It's not rocket science, it's actually easy. And we have, when we do assessments, when we go out and we do surveys and we know what's going on in the water, we can fix this, we can do this. It's not hard. It just takes, as you said, political will. But then it actually generates profits, it generates jobs, it generates income, and it generates a more stable, more productive ecological future. So it's really kind of inconceivable why we're not doing the same thing the U.S. is doing, just, you know, 100 miles south of the border. Why are we still dabbling with this? It's a fixable problem. And then, sorry to be negative, but to make matters worse, what we've done is we've displaced fishing effort onto things that we know even less about. Species like sea cucumbers, sea urchin, certain crabs, that are developing our emerging fisheries. And you see here the trend from a paper from Sean Anderson, Heike Lotzer at Dalhousie, the emerging fisheries and the developing are increasing rapidly, and established ones like cod and haddock and so are going down. So it's a shift, it's a displacement. There's absolutely crazy fisheries, like the lumpfish fishery, for example, which is a gillnet fishery in Newfoundland, where they just take the roe, so the caviar of the lumpfish. It's a spawning migration, so they're catching them before they spawn, because that's where they're trying to get it. There's tons of seals and other marine mammals, whales following them, trying to eat them. They also get caught in the gillnets. There's no assessment. There's no biomass estimate. There's no nothing. And it was a traditional fishery, you know, of a few hundred tons. And after the cod collapse, they just put a whole bunch of fishermen into this fishery. They say, do that. But there was no science, absolutely no science associated with it. So I just looked at the most recent stock status report and it said, well, they're not there anymore and the fishery has collapsed and we don't know what's going on because we've never looked. So that's the kind of rationale. It's also happening in the Arctic. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Moving fisheries up the coasts, turbot, Greenland halibut, deep water shrimp, are examples of fisheries that are developed there, also with very little oversight. Here's just to give this this general, where actually someone sat down and quantified how much we know. These are the population knowledge factors that you want to know. These are the traditional fisheries, developing fisheries, doing okay, and then the emerging fisheries doing very poorly. There was one person at the Bedford Institute of Oceanography who was whose file was to look into all of the emerging fisheries scientifically, and that position has also been cut recently. And then just to talk a little bit about habitat impacts and bycatch, this is the other side of fisheries where we're impacting things we're actually not targeting. And then obviously different fishing gears have different impacts. This is from an exercise that a bunch of NGOs and government agencies did where they had fishermen actually rate those impacts along with some scientists. And you see that some are coming out quite poorly. And again, there's very little effort to move fisheries away from these fisheries and towards cleaner fisheries, which I think would fix a lot of problems on that front. But there's just limited resources within DFO now to deal with these problems, to develop viable alternatives. Oh, yeah, and then another big shift we're seeing is worldwide, by the way, this is not just Canada, is the shift from wild capture fisheries to aquaculture. So aquaculture is, I don't know if you knew this, is the fastest growing food sector in the world with some margin. Most of aquaculture is land-based freshwater aquaculture, carp, tilapia, things like that. And then another big chunk is filter feeders, mussels, oysters, and so on. That's where most of the volume comes from and also where most of the growth is. But in Canada, most of the growth is in salmon aquaculture. And it's an open net pen aquaculture. You probably know most about it. Here's some of the problems that are very well documented, like disease and parasite transfer to wild salmon. Big, big, big concern on the West Coast, recent moratorium on aquaculture expansion there. And so the industry just moves to the East Coast. And as I said, in Nova Scotia, they convinced the government to increase by 10% every year, which is an enormous growth rate. Basically, this industry, in my view, is profitable because all of the environmental costs are externalized. They don't pay for any of the pollution they do. It's like having a hog farm directly in the ocean, not just putting the effluent in the ocean, but actually having it in the ocean. It's exactly what it is. And there's a solution. It's well documented. In Nova Scotia, there's a number of facilities that are already closed containment for halibut, for Arctic char, for some other species. This can be done for salmon. It's, again, a matter of political will. And it will make this industry less profitable, and that's where the problem is. Okay, so I talk quite a bit about fisheries and aquaculture just because it's something we actually know quite a lot about, and we know what to do by and large. We know how to rebuild depleted stocks, and it works. When we do it, it works like a charm. Not in every single case. The Newfoundland cod is a famous example. But now after 20 years, it starts increasing finally since there were some ecosystem changes there that prevented it from increasing, but that's now happening. There's a challenge about going on to new species without properly studying them, or in some cases without studying them at all. We know what to do. We need to find out about something before we start hammering it. And then I talked about the aquaculture and the containment issue as well. So clearly laid out solutions used in some cases in Canada and elsewhere. So a problem that I think we have a good handle on. The problem we don't have a very good handle on, and I'm actually shocked, I do a lot of work on fisheries and climate change interactions worldwide. But I did a search over the last few days, climate change and fisheries in Canada, and there's very little information on it. So my impression from the peer-reviewed literature, at least, is that we really don't quite understand what it does to our fisheries. The one thing we do know is that ice is retreating much more rapidly than models predict in the Arctic, and this opening up a lot of new waters that have never been fished. So these are some of the last wildernesses, actually. Most of the global ocean is fished and has been fished for a long time, but the Arctic Ocean is one of the very, very, very few exceptions. So the question here from a societal point of view is, do we just want to do the exact same thing we did elsewhere? For example, almost all ecosystems before we fished them had lots of sharks and rays. Sharks have been top predators in the ocean for 400 million years. They know how to survive. They survive 5 mass extinctions. They don't know how to survive fisheries at all. So that's why much of the Caribbean is shark-free now. Most of Europe is shark-free now. Most of Asia is shark-free now. In Canada, in the Canadian Arctic, we still have a lot of sharks, mostly one species, Greenland sharks, another species, black dogfish. A very large species that, again, there's a common theme here, we know almost nothing about. It's probably one of the least productive species of fish on the planet, from the little bit we know. But we don't know for sure. But we're catching huge numbers now as bycatch as we're developing Arctic fisheries. There's no assessment. There's very little science going into it. There's some. And it's a common theme. So here's the expansion of Arctic fishing efforts, something I'm personally very concerned about. Fisheries pushing north with the lack of knowledge and assessment. I'm all for fishing resources when there's assessment, when we actually know what we're doing, when we have the steering wheel and we have the windshield wipers and we see the road and we know where it's leading. We don't know in these cases. There's large bycatch of sharks. Here's some Greenland sharks on the ice, and also of habitat structures such as sponges. A huge spike in bycatch of sponge and sponge destruction of sponge reefs after the cod collapse because fisheries started moving up north, trawling previously unimpacted habitats. And then compounded by that, so we're putting new pressures on these ecosystems, and also they're changing very rapidly. And again, as Norman said, it's not all bad. The Arctic is actually the place on the planet, according to this publication, which will see the largest increase in species richness in relative terms, in percent change, of anywhere. Because you have a large number of southerly species moving in this case a number of baleen whales and toothed whales, particularly, that are increasing in abundance and species richness in these habitats. We're already witnessing that. You can be sure it's not only the marine mammals, also plankton organisms and everything in between. And it's rearranging the ecological makeup of that ecosystem. That's neither good nor bad. It just is. But it's a time of ecological change and possibly turmoil. And the question is, can we safely exploit this ecosystem while it's being rearranged, as it were? And there's probably an answer to that, but we don't have it. So these are the challenges, the ecological turnover, the rapid expansion, not just of fisheries, also of oil and gas and other industries, and that I think there is an argument that the adaptive capacity may be low because of that rapid ecological change. We know the solutions, by and large, reduce carbon emissions, obviously control the rate of warming, and invest into scientific capacity to understand and monitor change. It's as simple as that. Just know what's going on before you're messing with it. And we haven't done this in the past. The Europeans certainly didn't have that capacity when they came to exploit the Grand Banks, but we have it now. But we're throwing it away. So now we're moving into more speculative territory. What's not speculative is that there's some gradients of pH across the world oceans, areas of low pH, particularly in upwelling regions, and areas of higher pH, particularly at higher latitudes. And what you can see in all the relevant data sets, and it's basic water chemistry, is if you're increasing atmospheric CO2, you're increasing the seawater partial pressure of CO2, you're producing carbonic acid, and so the seawater pH falls. And the seawater pH has already fallen by 0.05 on the pH scale, which is something that would make you very sick if it happened in your blood. But it's happening in the ocean, and it has only been on the radar for about 10 years, so it's an emerging issue, although it's one that's becoming more widely known now. It's mostly a concern on the West Coast because the West Coast naturally has relatively low pH because of upwelling of waters that has been locked down in the deep sea for 1,000 to 2,000 years. And the concerning trend here is that the acidic carbon-rich waters are becoming more prevalent along parts of the West Coast, particularly Oregon, Washington, and going into British Columbia. And this is already causing problems, for example, for oyster larvae. So this is a recent paper from an oyster hatchery in Oregon, and they have an intake pipe where they get water in from the natural environment, and that water goes up and down in pH diurnally, but also with upwelling events. And they looked at the hatching success and the larval production based on the pH. So acidification increases from right to left. What's actually plotted there is the aragonite saturation of the water. So how easy it is, basically a measure of how easy it is to form calcium skeleton or shells in that water. And you see that there's a fairly strong correlation between aragonite depth and the larva production. So the more acidic it is, the less likely the larvae are to survive. And for that reason, and I was surprised to hear that, the very large oyster growing industry in Washington and Oregon is actually currently relocating to Hawaii. Because it's a much safer place to do business now, because you have these episodic events that are killing all the larvae, and so that's not good for the hatcheries. And they're relocating to Hawaii and building large facilities there that hopefully will be safe for these larvae for the foreseeable future. Obviously, that's a huge cost, and I think it's one of the first economic impacts that ocean acidification actually has. So, this is the challenge, water's turning acidic, problems for shell-building organisms particularly. For some others as well, there's well-documented effects on reef fish becoming, to use your expression, dim-witted and not being able to escape their predators anymore in more acidic waters. But the ecosystem effects are highly uncertain. I would submit that at this point, we really don't have a clue how a more acidic ocean will work. We know it will have less calcifying organisms, possibly more gelatinous ones, but how ecosystems will adapt and evolve in a more acidic oceans, we simply don't know. We know the solutions, again, scientific capacity, reduce carbon emissions, and maybe have early warning systems if waters are becoming too acidic. From an industry point of view, if you're a hatchery or an aquaculture operation or a fishery, you may want to know about it. Okay, and the last challenge I wanted to talk about is the emerging pollutants. So these are microplastics here shown on a penny. For comparison. So again, you may be familiar with this for longer than I have, but I only became familiar with this a few weeks ago when I interviewed two students who were doing research into microplastics in Nova Scotia. The one was working on mussels, and she looked at the amount of microplastics in mussels, and she consistently found between 100 and 300 plastic particles per five mussels. So that was her five mussels. So dozens per mussel. And then she asked the question, how is this different from wild mussels to farmed mussels? So she looked at farmed mussels, and they had about double to triple the amount. The reason being they're grown on poly ropes that shed and disintegrate and shed little fibers, and they're sucked in by the mussel right there. And they don't go away. That's a problem. They're not assimilated. They're not broken down. They don't go away. It's a health risk for us right here, right now, because a lot of us wear plastic garments, and this carpet is probably plastic, and it all sheds tiny fibers that float through the air. When the sunbeam comes in, you can actually see them, and we breathe them in. And it's like asbestos in that it doesn't go away. It lodges in the lungs, and it doesn't break down, and it can't be assimilated in any way. And there's just unknown health concerns about this. What does it do to us? What does it do to the mussels? What does it do to us when we eat the mussels? We don't know. The problem is they're incredibly ubiquitous. People have done surveys in very, very remote places. Microplastics are absolutely everywhere. They're like plankton. They move very freely around the world. They actually have a similar buoyancy and size spectrum as plankton, and so they're also eaten up by plankton-feeding organisms indiscriminately. So the pitch I want to make here is that there's known problems with heavy metals, DDT, some antifoulins like tributyl tin, which had horrible effects in the 70s and 80s. All of these are on their way out, and that's great. But then there's these other things that are partly under the radar or just emerging now as problems, like microplastics, like hormone mimics, like the bisphenol A that was in the water bottles, like flame retardants, like polybromated bisphenol ethers, for example, or other polybromated compounds that are absolutely everywhere. And they're increasing very rapidly in breast milk, they're increasing in sperm whales, they're increasing in the marine environment. And oftentimes, we're not quite clear on what the effects are. The problem is, before we know the effects, they're everywhere. And that's obviously was true for DDT as well. It was true for the heavy metals, and it's true for these emerging pollutants. The global production of plastics is actually 280 million tons, which I think is just an astounding figure. Just to give you the total fisheries and aquaculture production globally is about half that, about 140 million tons. So we're producing twice as much plastic as all the seafood and aquaculture on land and freshwater and the sea combined. At least 10% is estimated to reach the marine environment. It's accumulating there, just like DDT did, because it has a long residence time and is ingested by many animals. You probably have seen these photos of birds stuffed with plastic, particularly in the Pacific area. But this is different from the microplastics. So the microplastics are defined as plastic particles less than 1 millimeter. There's primary microplastics that were made to be small. This is the stuff that's in exfoliants and certain cleaning products and so on, the gritty stuff. You could use something else. You could use coffee grinds, for example, as an exfoliant. But often these plastic particles are used. They're produced specifically for that purpose, and they're released into the marine environment. The other student I interviewed, she looked at sediments and looked at how many plastic particles were in sediments, and said that the round stuff, there were too many for her to count. She could actually not quantify them, so she just quantified the fibers, which were easier to count, not as abundance. Enormous amounts. Fibers in the second picture there. And then the secondary microplastics are the ones that are broken down trash and rope and fibers that were not produced that way, but they're basically just the breakdown products from larger particles. One concern with microplastics, and again, all of this just coming out in papers last year and the year before, is that they take up other pollutants and act as vectors for those pollutants. So some plastics have chemical capacity to absorb a lot of heavy metals, for example, or organochlorines and act as vectors. These are the trends. As you can imagine, we're producing more and more plastic. That's the dotted line. And we're seeing more and more microplastics. This is a study from Belgium. But the trend is the exact same everywhere we look. And, you know, here I'm just throwing my hands up, as did the people who wrote this paper. It's a recent review paper on the effects of microplastics. And it was a 2013 paper, I think. And I thought, oh, wow, they're figuring out the effects. But no, they're just figuring out the possible pathways it could take. But they're just throwing their hands up and say it could have effects, or maybe not, or we don't know. So we'll better get busy and study this. Okay, so I talked mostly about emerging challenges, making the point that when we have scientific understanding, often fairly rapidly, depending on political will and the legislative framework we build around these problems, we can fix these problems effectively. But then we're creating new problems, like the displacement of fishing, climate warming, ocean acidification, emerging pollutants, that we need to deal with them in the same way. And I agree with Norman. I'm basically, and maybe not an optimist, but I'm certainly hopeful. I'm certainly hopeful that we have the capacity to deal with all of these problems in an effective manner. But in order for that, we need to be able to understand them, to discuss them, and to mitigate them. And that depends on our scientific capacity as a first necessary step. And then on our democratic culture as well, which is very strong in Canada, I find. It's a consensus-driven society. But that seems to be changing as well. The good news is solutions exist for all of these problems. None of them is a problem where we say we just can't do anything. It's not an asteroid hitting the Earth. It's things that we did and that we can do away with. A lot of these problems are very recent. They didn't exist 100 years from now. And they didn't exist 100 years ago, and hopefully they won't exist 100 years from now. More generally speaking, I feel that oceans have to become a societal priority for Canada. Canada is an ocean nation. It's a maritime nation. It has an extremely large ocean area and with important resources, a large ocean economy that's growing very rapidly. And I think it has to become more of a societal and maybe political priority. It certainly is not now, and I think that's regrettable. So I thank everyone, and maybe we have time for questions. Thanks for inviting me.
break, but during the coffee break, if you want to ask questions here, if you don't mind that, we can do that. But otherwise, we'd resume at 11:05.
By the way, that is the Green and Shark in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, not far from here in Baie-Comeau. They're coming there every fall and winter. And it's a magnificent creature, the only true Canadian shark. And we know almost nothing about it. But it's an amazing creature.